Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Insulin, The Crooked Timber, a history from thick brown muck to Wall Street gold, by Kirsten T. Hall, narrated by Mike Cooper. Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. Immanuel Kant, German philosopher, 1724 to 1804. Preface. On the shoulders of giants? When Theresa May first received the shock diagnosis of type 1 diabetes while serving as Home Secretary in 2013, her response was one of admirable stoicism. It's just part of life, so it's a case of head down and getting on with it. Echoing a piece of advice given to her by athlete Sir Steve Redgrave, she resolved that diabetes must learn to live with me rather than me live with diabetes. That's the attitude. Her grit in dealing with such a life-changing event was impressive, but had she been born just over 100 years ago, no amount of stoicism, however heroic, would have saved her from a grim and cruel fate. For before the discovery of insulin, a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes was an inevitable death sentence. Thankfully, that is no longer the case. Thanks to daily injections of insulin, Theresa May went on to lead the nation, England and Exeter rugby centre Henry Slade has won 26 caps, and actor James Norton may well yet take up 007's licence to kill. Like them, I owe my life to insulin. But why go to the trouble of writing a book about it? Why not simply take the daily injections and be grateful? What more needs to be said? Why worry about who discovered it, who unravelled its chemical structure, and who first grasped that ordinary gut bacteria could be coaxed into making it? And if you don't even have diabetes, well, why waste precious hours of your life listening to a book about the history behind insulin? My motivation here could be expressed as in for a penny, in for a pound. History matters. The common ground between the protesters who toppled the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol in June 2020 and those who objected to their actions is that both groups felt passionately that the past was too important to be forgotten. For me, the history of the discovery of insulin is worth recording here. Admittedly, an intimate knowledge of the history of science is unlikely to bring about social and political justice or atonement for past wrongs in the way that those who toppled the statue of Colston hoped to achieve. And while the products of science can save lives, the medical benefits of knowing its history are yet to be demonstrated. But before casting this book aside as just another dry science book, it might be worth reflecting on the words of the molecular biologist Marshall Nirenberg, who was awarded the 1968 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for helping to decipher the genetic code. A year earlier, Nirenberg had given an address in which he set out the challenge that this technology would bring. When man becomes capable of instructing his own cells, he must refrain from doing so until he has sufficient wisdom to use this knowledge for the benefit of mankind. The reason I state this problem well in advance of the need to do so is because the decisions concerning the application of this knowledge ultimately must be made by society, and only an informed society can make such decisions wisely. In 1968, the idea that we could instruct our own cells still belonged to the realms of science fiction. But in 2020, just over half a century after Nirenberg gave this address, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier for developing CRISPR-Cas9, in effect, a pair of molecular scissors that allows precise alteration of the genetic code. CRISPR-Cas9 may revolutionize what it means to be human, but while it raises the very real possibility of being able to treat debilitating genetic diseases, it also allows permanent alterations to the human genome that could be passed on down the generations. With a scientist in China already having claimed to have altered the genes of human embryos using CRISPR, this technology will bring formidable ethical, social, and political challenges. But long before genetic engineering had become a reality, Nirenberg had already recognized that the challenges it raised could not be left to scientists alone to solve. The debates around this new technology were too important to remain confined to the laboratory and needed the engagement of what Nirenberg called an informed society. For a scientifically informed society, we need first to understand how science works. Surely the best way of understanding science is to study its history. For, as the philosopher and mathematician Alfred North Whitehead warned in an address to the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1916, a science which hesitates to forget its founders is lost. But as Nirenberg's fellow Nobel laureate Sidney Brenner once lamented, scientists are sometimes the worst offenders as regards ignorance about their own history. For most young molecular biologists, the history of their subject is divided into two epochs, the last 2 years and everything else before that. The present and the very recent past are perceived in sharp detail, but the rest is swathed in a legendary mist where Crick, Watson, Mendel, Darwin, perhaps even Aristotle, coexist as uneasy contemporaries. Brenner's observation was more than just the typical Jeremiah grumblings of a middle-aged man about today's youth and their failings. Having once been one of those young molecular biologists of whom Brenner despaired, I think I can appreciate his point. Why should we care about who made a discovery or how it was made? Surely all that matters is that people in white coats keep on making breakthroughs and finding miracle cures so that a younger generation can build on those earlier successes. Alongside ignorance of the history of science, the particular way in which it is remembered can also be problematic. It is tempting to lay the blame for this on Sir Isaac Newton. In a letter written to Robert Hooke in 1675, Newton famously said that, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." Actually, it turns out that Newton was not being original, but rather was most likely quoting earlier sources, such as the 12th-century philosopher Bernard of Chartres. But regardless of its origin, it is a misattributed quote that is firmly established in popular consciousness. It conjures up an image that scientific progress is achieved by a succession of either lone geniuses or unsung pioneers far ahead of their time, whose work marks out a smooth, steady, triumphant ascent to the lofty pinnacles of present-day knowledge. Neither of these two approaches are helpful. Both obscure rather than illuminate the real workings of science. However, a far more compelling and honest description of how science really works comes from Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, the German Enlightenment philosopher. Known as the Sage of Königsberg, Kant once observed that out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing can ever be made. Kant's phrase was a favourite of the philosopher Isaiah Berlin, 1909 to 1997, who used it as the title for his exploration of the roots of fascism and totalitarianism, The Crooked Timber of Humanity, Chapters in the History of Ideas, first published in 1990. According to Nicholas Lazard, Berlin used Kant's phrase many times as a stick with which to beat those who would try to build heaven on earth or fit humanity into a straitjacket of their own design. However, it also lends itself wonderfully to the tortuous process of scientific discovery. It works particularly well when describing the discovery of insulin, which is not a tale of bold, lone geniuses or saints who set to work on improving the lot of humanity. Instead, it is a story of monstrous egos, toxic insecurities, and bitter career rivalry that at times resembles Game of Thrones, but enacted with lab coats and pipettes rather than chainmail and poisoned daggers. Some of the cast involved deserve our sympathy, while others are just plain odious. They regularly fought, sometimes wept, very often made mistakes, and in at least one case were partial to nude sunbathing. Since I began writing this book, this story has taken on a powerful new relevance for us all, whether or not we happen to have diabetes. For as experts appear on our television news reports each evening, talking of PCR, antibody tests and mRNA vaccines, or presenting graphs of infection rates at daily press briefings, science and its importance has come crashing into all of our lives. In years to come, as we look back on the COVID pandemic, there will once again be a temptation to tell a story of lone geniuses who boldly pioneered miraculous vaccines to bring the disease under control. But, like the discovery and development of insulin, as told here, success in bringing COVID-19 under control will be achieved not by standing on the shoulders of giants, but by being hewn from the crooked timber of humanity. And that alone will make it an achievement of which we can all be proud. Introduction. Taming the Tiger. As the colour on the test strip began to change, so too did the expression on my doctor's face. It was at that moment that I knew that I was in big trouble. For the past few weeks, I'd been experiencing symptoms of general low-level irritability and lethargy, all of which I had simply dismissed as being nothing more than inevitable middle age. But when these symptoms began to be accompanied by a sudden rapid weight loss, raging thirst, and a ravenous craving for sugar, faint alarm bells began to ring. At the same time, distant memories of undergraduate lectures in biochemistry began to stir. I'd always hoped that groggy hours spent in lectures on glycolysis and metabolism would one day somehow come in handy, but I could never have imagined the particular set of circumstances in which they would finally prove their worth. Spurred into action by half-remembered passages from textbooks, I visited my GP, who, horrified at my test results, made an urgent telephone call to St. James's Hospital. "You need to go there," he told me, as he hastily scribbled some notes. "You've made an appointment for me for later in the week?" I inquired. "No," he replied firmly. "You leave this surgery now and you go straight to the hospital." A series of blood tests at the hospital confirmed my hunch. There was so much sugar in my blood, it was as if it had turned to treacle. Poisonous compounds called ketones were raging through my system, which, if untreated, would acidify my blood and eventually put me potentially into a permanent coma. My body was in a state of metabolic meltdown, brought on by the onset of diabetes. I'd remembered enough to know that there were two forms of this condition. My first thought was that, having hit middle age, this must be type 2, the one which, were I to eat slightly less, drink slightly less, and run a bit more, might have some chance of being brought under control. But instead, I emerged from the hospital that day armed with a blood glucose testing kit and several syringes laden with insulin. I had, inexplicably, developed type 1 diabetes. It was little consolation to know that this rarer form of the condition usually presents in childhood or adolescence, but had, in my case, had the decency to delay its unwelcome appearance until my middle years. And from now on, insulin would be my constant companion, the biochemical crutch on which I would need to lean. There is a common misperception that diabetes is less serious than other chronic conditions, that life for a diabetic patient is just a matter of having to go easy on the cakes. However, in his book, Diabetes, the Biography, diabetologist Professor Robert Tattersall offers a very different perspective. A patient of mine who had had it for many years compared it to living with a tiger, since, as he said, if you look after it and never turn your back on it, you can live with a tiger. If you neglect it, it will pounce on you and rip you to shreds. This is no mere exaggeration for poetic effect. Patients with both forms of the condition face the possibility of blindness, neuropathy, amputations, kidney failure, and increased predisposition to cardiovascular disease and stroke. While there is still no cure for diabetes, it can be managed. For type 1 patients, management means multiple daily injections of the hormone insulin, usually with each meal, and the importance of this regime cannot be understated. One of the first consultants that I saw following my own diagnosis explained the gravity of the situation with stark and honest advice. "Take your insulin and you should be okay. Fail to take it and you're dead." He wasn't just being melodramatic. Prior to the discovery of insulin, a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes was a death sentence. Without insulin, the tissues of the body cannot obtain glucose that they need as a vital supply of energy from the blood. Deprived of their regular fuel source, they resort to burning fat and protein, which in turn leads to emaciation and the production of toxic compounds called ketones, which acidify the blood, resulting in slow suffocation, coma, and death. Thanks to the discovery of insulin, no diabetic patient today needs to suffer this grisly fate. I am personally very grateful for its discovery, but there are lessons for us all in what technology can, and perhaps more importantly, cannot do for us. Although insulin can save lives, it does not guarantee that those lives will be easy. Reprieved of early certain death, the diabetic patient faces a lifetime of daily injections, blood sugar tests, often in the most inconvenient or even embarrassing of situations, and an ever-present nagging worry about the many serious complications that can arise. The story of insulin is a drama in three acts. Act One takes place in Toronto in the early 1920s, where Fred Banting, a struggling but ambitious young doctor, discovered that extracts of pancreatic tissue, described by one of his colleagues as being simply thick brown muck, could save the lives of diabetic patients. But when Banting was awarded the Nobel Prize for this discovery, he was far from happy, and he quickly learned that fame came with a heavy price. Act Two takes place in the 1940s in West Yorkshire, and the setting is the unlikely field of wool chemistry, where, in a converted stable billowing with chloroform fumes, the scientists Archer Martin and Richard Singh developed a method that would eventually reveal insulin not to be thick brown muck, but a protein with a precise chemical structure. Although developed for the analysis of wool, this method, known as partition chromatography, also offered the first hint at how DNA carries the genetic message, a discovery that was crucial to the events of the final act in the tale. Act Three takes place under the sunnier skies of the US West Coast in the 1970s. It was there and then that scientists raced to use the newly discovered tools of genetic engineering to be the first to synthesize human insulin, despite facing vocal protest and opposition from a public and media frightened by this new technology. As a result of this race, several of the scientists involved became overnight multimillionaires, and patients with type 1 diabetes can now manage their condition with human insulin instead of material recovered from cows or pigs. But as impressive as this feat was it genuinely a medical breakthrough? Was it perhaps just a piece of scientific showmanship? Could it really be considered a miracle cure for diabetes, as so many press reports of the time hailed it? For that matter, is talk of miracle cures and medical breakthroughs helpful, or does it run the risk of inflating unrealistic expectations about what we can expect science and technology to do for us? Admittedly, questions of this sort are not always foremost in my mind as I insert a hypodermic needle into myself several times each day. After all, why should I, or anyone, care about who discovered insulin, or how it was discovered, as long as it saves lives? One of the main characters in this book may offer an answer here. Richard Singh was a biochemist who worked on a problem that seemed far removed from both the world of biomedical breakthroughs and the deep questions of biology. His day job was analyzing the chemical structure of wool for the purpose of improving textile fibers. Yet Singh was not averse to philosophical reflection about science and what it was there to do. He once wrote that, "To contemplate the grander and unexpected advances of natural knowledge does good to the souls of all engaged in scientific work and of many outside of it." I think that Singh was correct. Insulin may well be vital for my body, but its story, and many more like it, are equally vital for my soul. And as we face the post-pandemic world, these stories may have something to tell us all, whether or not we have diabetes. 1. The Pissing Evil. The earliest and also the most pronounced symptom of diabetes had first been recorded on a 3,000-year-old Egyptian scroll. In the winter of 1872 to 1873, Georg Ebers, a German Egyptologist, was in Thebes undertaking an examination of some ancient tombs when he was approached by a local who claimed to have found something that might interest him. Opening a tin box, the Egyptian produced a papyrus found in about 1858 that had been stuck between the legs of a mummy in the necropolis at Thebes. The scroll was perfectly preserved, and Ebers immediately recognized this as a priceless archaeological discovery, as did the current owner. Perhaps aware that a representative of the British Museum was currently in Luxor seeking to acquire the papyrus, its owner realized that he was in a seller's market and priced the artifact accordingly. Ebers must have been delighted, therefore, when a wealthy German merchant intervened to advance him the money for its purchase. The Ebers papyrus currently resides in the library of the University of Leipzig. Dating from around 1550 BCE, it is one of the oldest medical documents in the world and describes the preparation of medicines for a number of different pathological conditions, one of which is a treatment to drive away the too much emptying of urine. In the 2nd century CE, the physician Aretaeus of Cappadocia called this condition diabetes, derived from the ancient Greek word for to siphon or to flow, and he offered a vivid description of its most pronounced symptom. It consists of a liquefaction of the flesh and bones into urine, The kidneys and bladder, the usual passageways of fluid, do not cease emitting urine, and the outpouring is profuse and without limit. It is just as though aqueducts were opened wide. The development of this disease is gradual, chronic, but short will be the life of the man in whom the disease is fully developed. Emaciation proceeds quickly, and death occurs rapidly. Moreover, life for the patient is tedious and full of pain. The desire for drink grows ever stronger, but no matter what quantity of fluids he drinks, satisfaction never occurs, and he passes more urine than he drinks. He cannot be stopped from either drinking or urinating. However, the most candid and colourful description of diabetes and its symptoms comes from the English physician Thomas Willis, 1625 to 1675, who, in one section of his posthumously published work, Pharmaceutica Rationalis, described diabetes simply as the pissing evil. In the course of his work, Willis visited the markets held in the small towns around Oxford and offered to diagnose ailments by analysing samples of urine brought to him. Known as casting waters, this was hardly the height of medical sophistication. However, for diabetes it proved to be an effective method of diagnosis, thanks to one particular property of the diabetic patient's urine known to physicians since antiquity. The Hindu physicians Charaka, 3rd century BCE, and Sushruta, 6th century BCE, described a condition characterized by urine that tasted sweet. Diagnosis occurred either by tasting the patient's urine or observing the ants gathered around it. From the latter, it became known by the Indian name of Madhumeha, meaning urine of honey. Liverpool physician Matthew Dobson, 1735 to 1784, first showed why the urine produced in such great quantities by diabetic patients tasted so sweet. In 1776, Dobson published a paper describing a patient with diabetes who, on admission to the hospital 4 years earlier, had been emaciated, weak and dejected. His thirst was unquenchable, and his skin dry, hard and harsh to the touch, like rough parchment. The most pronounced symptom, however, was that the patient passed 28 pints of urine every 24 hours, and which Dobson noted had a sweetish smell and was very sweet to the taste. Curious, Dobson warmed the urine with a gentle heat and observed that there remained after the evaporation a white cake. This cake was granulated and broke easily between the fingers. It smelled sweet like brown sugar. Neither could it, by the taste, be distinguished from sugar, except that the sweetness left a slight sense of coolness on the palate. Within only a few years of Dobson having described this white cake, the clinician Francis Home, 1719 to 1813, showed that the urine of a diabetic patient was so sweet that it could actually be fermented into what he described as a tolerable small beer. This characteristic and distinct sweetness of the urine led the Edinburgh doctor John Rollo to add the suffix mellitus, derived from the Greek and Latin words for honey, to the name diabetes. Rollo also devised the diet with which most patients would be treated during the 19th century. Reasoning that the high levels of sugar in the blood and urine of diabetic patients were formed in the stomach after eating vegetables, he concluded that the solution was to feed these patients with game or old meats which had been long kept, and as far as the stomach may bear, fat and rancid old meats, as pork. It is probably no surprise that many of Rollo's patients did not adopt this diet with much enthusiasm, with Rollo recording that one particular patient was strongly remonstrated with, and he was told the consequence of repeated deviations. The consequences of which Rollo warned his patients were far more serious than simply a frequent need to urinate. Rollo had himself observed the symptoms in his patients of the most common and serious complications of diabetes, including nerve damage caused by high levels of blood sugar. By the end of the 19th century, diabetes was also associated with retina and kidney damage. These complications continue for diabetic patients today. According to figures released by the charity Diabetes UK, treating the long-term complications of diabetes that arise from prolonged elevated levels of blood sugar cost 10% of the NHS annual budget, with diabetes being cited as the biggest cause in the UK of both blindness and lower limb amputations due to neuropathy. Accordingly, the General Assembly of the United Nations describes diabetes as a chronic, debilitating and costly disease associated with severe complications, which poses severe risks for families, states and the entire world. Before the discovery of insulin, however, these serious long-term complications of diabetes were less of an issue, simply for the grim reason that patients did not live long enough to experience them. Although the cause of the illness remained a mystery, by the early 19th century, important discoveries were being made about its nature. In 1815, the French chemist Michel Chevreul, 1786 to 1889, discovered that the cause of the sweetness in diabetic urine was grape sugar, glucose. Although this discovery marked the beginning of understanding diabetes as a chemical disorder, it also presented a paradox. How could the level of glucose have reached such high levels in these patients? The accepted orthodoxy at the time was that only plants were capable of synthesizing glucose, and that glucose could only be present in the blood of animals as a result of having eaten plant products. Yet, when the eminent French physiologist Claude Bernard, 1813 to 1878, began to tackle this question, he was surprised to find that glucose was present in the blood of animals that had been starved. Moreover, he also observed that blood leaving the liver of a dog had higher levels of sugar than the blood entering it. This suggested that the dog's liver was somehow making glucose. This hypothesis flew in the face of accepted thinking. The reality, as Bernard discovered, was not so straightforward. On examining the livers of his dogs, Bernard found that even though they'd been fed only on meat, they contained a starchy substance. He hypothesized that this substance might act as a store from which sugar could be released into the blood, and so he called it glycogen, meaning sugar-forming. He then went on to explore how the nervous system might control this process. In a famous experiment, he found that pricking the region of the fourth ventricle in a dog's brain flooded the blood with glucose from the liver's stores of glycogen, making the animal diabetic. Bernard's work had important implications for identifying the cause of diabetes. Its origins appeared to lie within the nervous system, and, as Professor of Physiology J.J.R. McLeod at the University of Toronto observed, this might explain why certain professions appeared to be more prone to diabetes. Diabetes is common in locomotive engineers and in the captains of ocean liners, that is, men who, in the performance of their daily duties, are frequently put under a severe nerve strain. It is apparently increasing in men engaged in occupations that demand mental concentration and strain, such as in professional and business work. But while he entertained the possibility that diabetes was ultimately a disorder of the nervous system, McLeod was also open to alternatives. This willingness to consider that the true cause of diabetes might lie elsewhere eventually led to him becoming one of the biggest names in the history of diabetes research. In 1889, Oskar Minkowski and Josef von Mehring at the University of Strasbourg conducted research that suggested diabetes might not be a disorder of the nervous system. While researching how the pancreas was involved in fat metabolism, Minkowski and Mehring took the radical step of removing the pancreas from a healthy dog. On the day after the surgery was performed, Mehring was urgently called out of town. On his own for over a week, Minkowski worked on and observed that, despite having been house-trained, the depancreatized dog was now leaving puddles of urine all over the laboratory floor. Thinking that this was because the poor animal had not been allowed enough outdoor exercise, Minkowski's first thought was to reprimand his servant for not having let the dog out frequently enough. In response, the poor servant responded, "I do, but the animal is queer. As soon as it comes back, it passes water again, even if it has just done so outside." Curious about the dog's behavior and the servant's explanation, Minkowski measured the concentration of sugar in the dog's urine and found it elevated well above normal levels. The depancreatized dog was exhibiting a classic symptom of diabetes mellitus. Thus, Minkowski suggested that the pancreas played a central role in the disease and queried how this might occur. One possibility was that the pancreas was essential for the removal of toxins that would otherwise cause diabetes, and that, in a diabetic patient, this function was impaired. Another possibility, however, was that, under normal conditions, the pancreas secreted some anti-diabetic substance that was missing in the diseased state. Minkowski was not the first physician to suggest a connection between diabetes and the pancreas, nor did his work mean that a pancreatic origin for the condition became universally accepted overnight. Minkowski tried to show that diabetes was not a disorder of the nervous system, but rather was due to some failure of the pancreas. His experiments attempted to demonstrate that transplants of pancreatic tissue might prevent diabetes in a dog. Similar experiments by Edouard Edon, 1863-1933, showed that a small graft of pancreatic tissue could have an anti-diabetic effect in a dog.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?